This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. On June 23, 1975, President Richard Nixon signed the law that would become known as Title IX. It prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in any federally funded education program or activity, including athletics. And joining us to discuss Title IX are Chief Title IX Officer at Xavier University's Title IX office, Kate Lawson, and President of Thomas More College, David Armstrong. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Kate and David, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Good to see both of you.
Thank you for having us on.
David, Title IX, just how much territory does this particular law cover?
Well, as a lawyer, I'll tell you that, laws actually, how they're applied can change over time. And Title IX was kind of this wonderful law that was made in the early 70s for great reason, because women were not getting equal access to educational opportunities. Where we first saw it used most was then in athletics in educational institutions. And so immediately people start thinking, well, Title IX is an athletic gender law. It's not. It's about educational opportunities. Athletics happen to be an educational opportunity at grade schools, high schools, and colleges. In Europe, that's not an issue. They keep their athletics separate from the educational institutions. But in our country, it's different. Over time now, and I've actually talked with some people from the Department of Education on this issue, the Office of Civil Rights, there was a feeling that Title IX was not being used appropriately and that there were more issues that we had to deal with from a gender discrimination standpoint and possible sexual violence as gender discrimination. And so there was another law called the Jean Cleary Act, the Cleary Law, which is a consumer protection act from the 80s and then the 90s, where college campuses have to provide information on crimes that occur on their campus or near their campus in order to protect students. And so it's a consumer protection law. Those entities, the people that were driving that law and the advocates for that and advocates for Title IX, kind of came together and said, you know what, we need to power up together and talk about safety on college campuses. And so then Title IX started really focusing on, from the Office of Civil Rights aspect, to possible sexual violence on campus for both genders, but mainly for women, because there was many concerns, rightly so, based on the stories that you heard. And so the law hasn't changed. The law has always been the same, but how it's been applied has evolved.
Mm-hmm. You talk about sexual violence, but sexual harassment would be part of this too. Is that right, Kate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would add, I think if you ask students of this generation, they're the most educated on Title IX, and they really have come to age, not just in college and university level, but also in high school, really having an understanding of the broad scope of Title IX in a way that the generation, I think, before them did not have, courtesy of, over the last 5 to 7 years, just this issue exploding onto the national consciousness and the scene, so that it's a very literate generation of students who understand that Title IX is not just about gender equity in our athletic programs, but is about issues of sexual assault, sexual harassment, really any form of gender-based violence, harassment, or discrimination. So I think in many ways, what I'm always finding myself saying in front of all audiences, students, parents, faculty, et cetera, is that I think Title IX is actually as broad as we may have thought it was narrow a generation ago. There's a very well-deserved, I think, spotlight on student-on-student sexual assault over the last 5 years, where we've paid a lot of attention, which is a good thing. But I have to say, as a sort of daily practitioner of Title IX work, my work is much broader. It includes that, and that is critical work. But I'm also dealing with issues much broader, gender discrimination in the classroom, the interpersonal pieces of sexual harassment. And it does apply to employees and visitors, too. And I think sometimes that kind of gets swept to the side, not to mention Title IX's protections for pregnant and parenting folks. So it really is that broad.
Mm-hmm. Is the fact that it covers so much territory and that it is so broad, is that what makes it so difficult to comply with, David?
Yes, there's no doubt that that's an issue now. The federal government has declared that we needed to ramp up all our Title IX enforcement. They requested that every college have a full-time Title IX compliance coordinator, investigators, and so there's been direction that we should do all those things, and you have to in order to keep up to the expansiveness of that law. And it's tough, and especially for smaller institutions that have less funding. You know, it's basically an unfunded mandate, and that makes it very difficult. And I've been very critical of that over the years, in that, you know, everyone on this side is saying that college education costs too much. But then we have, again, good cause over here to say we have to do things to protect students and follow federal laws. Okay, well, then we got to hire all these people, and then where do we get that money from? It's certainly unfunded, so what do we have to do? We have to raise tuition. And so there's this yin and this yang that is a difficult thing to manage. And so it's one of the reasons why at Thomas More College we started an Institute for Higher Education Compliance, which we had our first conference this year on July 18th, made it a very inexpensive conference to help schools navigate these issues and be able to handle it with the resources they have, because the bottom line is you have to do it. And so you better have a plan to make sure that your people are educated on campus. And Kate made a great point. It's not just student to student. It's employee to student. It's employee to employee. It's faculty to faculty. And I've always contended that any third-party vendors, to me, they should be trained, and they're a part of it too. And so and the federal government hasn't extended it that far yet, but that's how I'm approaching it, because I think that's where it's going to go. And so it is difficult, along with all the other things that we're doing, to be able to do that. Does it make us better? Absolutely. But it's a challenge.
What was the reaction to the conference that you had?
Oh, I couldn't be happier. We decided in March to do this and to give it a go. My people wanted to wait another year to try and give it some legs, but I said, no, we can make this happen. And we had over 120 attendees. Our goal was to get 100. And we had people from over 27 different institutions from all over the country. And we actually did it in a one-day deal so that they didn't have to spend too much money in hotels, that they can drive in. But we actually had people fly in and the night at the Reds game. So it was a lot of fun. But we learned a lot. And Kate was there, and she may have a couple comments.
Yeah, I was. I thought it was fantastic, actually. And what I really appreciated about it, and what I think made it stand out a bit from the many, many conferences I think that we all go to, was really the multiple sort of intersecting agencies and organizations, because when students or employees experience sex discrimination, you know, their lives don't end at our walls. So we need to have relationships with local law enforcement, with community organizations, because it really, these issues, the impact of gender-based violence and sex discrimination really expands out. Yes, it impacts the person who it happens to, but it also impacts their roommates, their teammates, their families, the communities within which they walk. So what I liked about the Thomas More conference was that it really brought together the key players. Because if we're not talking to each other, we're making a very difficult issue for an individual to experience even more difficult by having to tell their story five different times. You know, there are ways we can collaborate proactively to say, hey, listen, I know you wanted to report to the police. I just want to let you know that I can share what you reported to me so that you don't have to go through all of that again, because we have a very strong relationship. To me, that was the real value of that conference.
I really appreciate that comment, Kate, because our people put a lot of work into it. We have four pillars within our Institute for Higher Compliance: Title IX compliance, ADA compliance, accreditation, and athletics. One of the reasons why I started the Institute was because lightning has struck twice in my life. I was at the center of the Title IX and Cleary confluence at Notre Dame College in Cleveland, and then I had the NCAA issue at Thomas More. And so I want to make sure that other people don't have to go through that. And so if I can educate people and give them that opportunity, that's what we want to do. From the Title IX perspective, actually there was a great movement that now I think is coming forward. Our keynote speakers at the end of the day were Gina Maestro-Smith and Leslie Gomez. They were at Pepper Hamilton and did the investigation at Baylor, which is the biggest case in the country right now in Title IX discrimination. They have now moved on to O'Connor and Kazin. They were our major sponsor of the conference, and at the end, they were phenomenal, gave the keynote, and they said that there is movement by the federal government and other state governments to bring educational institutions together with policing communities and other entities and the government, so it's not just all on the colleges. And that's something I've been saying for 10 years now, is that you can't put all of this on colleges that really their mission is to educate, okay? Asking them to do investigations and be judge, jury, and executioner in a lot of cases. And so it's very good to see this movement because, as Kate has always said, and I like this, she says, "Is hey, we're better for all this. It is a challenge, but we're better for it, and we're better for our students. But it's good to hear that there's a movement that we get more people involved in this so that the like you said earlier, is that we're bringing all these entities together because we don't want to be doing this in silos.
Do small colleges, small universities, does this have more of an impact on them, David, or who feels this the most?
Oh, no, it's everybody. Xavier's gone through it. UC's gone through it. NKU's gone through it. Miami of Ohio. So when the federal government comes and knocks on your door and says, we want to talk about this instance and we want you to give all your records for the last 3 years on every incident that ever occurred, that's going to really put a challenge on any institution, no matter the size.
I do think size can be challenging, really, what it comes to what you mentioned a little bit earlier, which is resources. I mean, I think at Xavier, I think, you know, I feel very blessed to have doing Title IX be my only job. It matters. I'm able to have the visibility and leadership and be in the sort of community outward facing, you know, being part of the leadership for the Cincinnati Task Force to address campus gender-based violence. But I do think that some of the smaller institutions do struggle. You know, some of my colleagues still wear multiple hats, you know, head of HR, also Title IX. And I think that's a very difficult problem for universities without resources or smaller to face, to figure out, you know, how do we prioritize the many issues that our students are facing, from mental, you know, rise of mental health issues, gender-based violence issues, et cetera. So I think we're all impacted the same. And then I think it's a question of, you know, where are our resources? What are we going to prioritize? And that can be challenging.
Yeah. What are the penalties for noncompliance?
An individual who feels that their university or their education institution, you know, this, again, speaking of broad, this is kindergarten through doctorate, anyone who receives any federal
funding.
Anybody
who gets federal funding.
That's exactly
funding.
Right.
Yep. I think that's something I wasn't quite aware of because I always looked at this as being a university level.
Yes, and I don't think you're alone in that, which is another way I think people thought it was narrow. So if someone feels that their education institution is not compliant, they certainly have the right, which I think we're all familiar with, to file a complaint with the Department of Education Office for Civil Rights. And then certainly there's always a private right of action against a university, which I think we're seeing an uptick in over the last 5 years as students and employees and visitors understand their rights and options if a university, in their view, is not in full compliance with Title IX.
And so the Office of Civil Rights cannot levy fines. However, what they can do, if they feel that they're not being followed and you're not following the law under the auspices of the Office of Civil Rights, they can hand the case over to the Department of Justice. And that almost occurred in two different cases. I know the Missouri, University of Missouri case, not Missouri, Montana. Mm-hmm. The Montana case was getting close to that. You had rampant cover-up and issues that they were dealing with. And with the Department of Justice, now they can bring criminal sanctions and or fines, criminal fines against you. Now, the whole Cleary thing I talked about earlier, there are fines for violating the Cleary Act.
And Cleary extended this to sexual violence, sexual harassment. Is that right, David?
Well, there's a whole listing of criminal the crimes that occur on a campus that you have to disclose. And if you don't disclose those, every time you do not disclose, that's a certain fine. Okay, and so that can really ramp up, like the Penn State case. You may have heard that they're up into the hundreds of thousands of penalties. That's because each time they didn't give a warning and each time they didn't do something, another fine gets tacked on. Okay, so it can be a monetary situation. At where I was at Notre Dame College, our initial fine was $155,000. We had six instances that we did not report, did not give a warning to our campus. Okay, so that's what their claim. We were able to negotiate that down to about $80,000. But I mean, you talk about a small college. We don't have $80,000 in our budget, you know, to handle a fine. So that's the point of the Institute for Higher Ed Compliance. You better get on board. You better do what you need to do. Again, not to avoid fines. That is a good positive. It's to make your place better. You know, both institutions. I said this the other day. Was it tough to go through all those things? Absolutely. But in the end, we were better before they even made their final decision. Okay, and it's about making your campus better for your students so they get the best student experience possible.
Kate, what do you think? What do colleges and universities need to realize about Title IX? What's the biggest thing they need to take into account?
I think the biggest thing for me would be for universities and colleges to realize how much leadership and visibility and resourcing doing Title IX work well takes, and also sort of the level of expertise. I think it's a particular skill set. Now, interestingly, I think, 7 years ago, Title IX wasn't really a professional field. Now, you have thousands and thousands and thousands of professionals, attending conferences that are specifically about sort of how to do this work. So it's been fascinating. This whole professional field has arisen. And I think it's schools that wait for a complaint to happen or a lawsuit or whatever it is to really proactively staff with expertise and experience and the appropriate skill set, their Title IX programs that really end up, at learning a very difficult lesson in many ways. And then I also think for me, one of the most important things for universities and colleges to, I guess, realize and also implement is that at Xavier, for example, we really see, addressing gender-based violence and sex discrimination as a part of our mission. And I think when the work becomes part of the mission, as opposed to sort of compliance-driven, then it really can change the culture and the approach and the way we engage with students and parents and the whole conversation to say, look, we've seen on the ground this is a complex and consequential issue that really jeopardizes people's educational lives, not to mention their mental and physical health. If education institutions can't be leaders, who can be? And I think we're really in a very positive position to be leaders. And you've seen across the country, universities saying, we're not going to be fearful of or reactive to compliance. We're going to go proactive and say, how can we move the needle on this issue? Because it matters to our students' educational lives. And I think when a university makes that mental shift, then you start to say, oh, well, of course this needs to be resourced in this way. So those would be the sort of key points for me.
Yeah. And to add on to a couple of Kate's comments, I agree that the Chronicle of Higher Education gives out a daily briefing and the comings and goings in positions. The majority of the positions are comings and goings are diversity, inclusion, and Title IX. So it's created this whole industry now. And I'll admit it, some people have made money off of this, a lot of money, trying to educate people. And again, that's a choice that people make. Again, positive for the culture. Here's where I criticize the Office of Civil Rights, the federal government. I'd much rather have them tell me beforehand what they want and how we should do it correctly rather than after the fact. And I think that we are now getting – there's going to be a culture shift, I think, where the government is going to work with institutions more to help us do that better. We're educators. What we try to do is educate our students to be able to go and make right decisions. I'm asking the federal government to do the same thing for us. Educate us so we can make the right decisions. And that'll help us allocate our resources and all those things at the same time. I want people to understand is that we're not coddling our students.
You're not against Title IX. You see them saying something that has been beneficial.
It's a benefit. It's a wonderful law.
We just want some clarity is what you're saying.
Women's basketball will still be playing half court. That's insane. I mean, we have national champion women basketball team, that we had a year ago. And so, that's insane to think that. And so gender equality is so important, especially in an educational institution. And again, and I'll jump on Kate's comments here. Mission. It's mission-centric. The last phrase in our mission statement says, we educate students to understand the ultimate meaning of life, their place in the world, and responsibility to others. Taking care of people, keeping people safe, giving them a great educational opportunity, that's responsibility to others.
Yeah, Kate, what would you say to students about the last minute we have here on this segment? But what would you tell students? What do they need to know about Title IX?
Well, my biggest message would be to get educated and get involved. Title IX is in many ways about response to gender-based violence. And I think one of the things we're really trying to focus on at Xavier, and I know across the country, is to talk about these issues in a proactive prevention posture, to have peer-to-peer dialogue about what is consent, what is sexual harassment. Students create social norms, and they can change social norms. So my biggest message to students is to educate themselves, hold their universities accountable for both prevention and response, and instead of sort of having Title IX put upon them, to become part of the conversation and really step up to be leaders. Because I can get in front of a group of students and talk until I'm blue in the face about Title IX, but they are going to hear so much better from each other, and they are who set the community expectations at Xavier.
Kate and David, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Xavier University's Title IX Office Director, Kate Lawson, and President of Thomas More College, David Armstrong. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Most of us know to call 911 in case of emergency, but what if no one answers? On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll discuss the reliability of Cincinnati's 911 system. And we'll talk with David Fankhauser, who took part in the 1960s Freedom Rides to protest racial segregation. He and other Freedom Riders were arrested for refusing to leave the waiting room of a whites-only bus station in Mississippi. That's Cincinnati Edition, Thursday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.